You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 6, given in Munich on the 27th of February, 1912. Entitled Hidden Forces in Soul Life. In recent days we have been talking about the presence of hidden depths in the soul, and it is always good if we can take up this theme and engage in issues useful to students of spiritual science. In general, it has to be said that fuller elucidation and elaboration is only possible on a foundation of what has so far been shared of spiritual science. We have explored from the most varied perspectives what we might call the stratified structure of the human being. It should therefore be fairly straightforward to imagine what now emanates from a different angle in pursuit of hidden depths of the soul, so that we relate correctly to the constituent parts of the human being as we know them from the somewhat elementary depictions of a spiritual worldview so far given. It has been repeatedly said over the last days that what encompasses our concepts, our percepts, our impulses of will, our feelings and sentience, in short, everything that takes place in our souls under normal circumstances between waking and falling asleep, can be called the activities, idiosyncrasies, and forces of normal consciousness. Now, we want to describe what comes under the aegis of normal consciousness, that is, everything that a person knows, feels, and wills between waking up and falling asleep, in terms of two parallel lines, A and B, see diagram. Isn't it so that not only our concepts, but also every kind of perception, belongs within this area of the parallel lines? If we transpose ourselves via our senses so as to correspond with the outer world, thereby creating a picture of that outer world via all manner of sense impressions, while remaining connected with, in touch with the outer world, this will also belong to our normal everyday consciousness. Also belonging to this area are all our feelings and impulses of will. In short, everything encompassed by our normal consciousness. We could say that everything transmitted to us every day through normal soul life also belongs within this area between parallel lines A and B. Now, it is a matter of clearly recognizing that our so-called normal soul life is dependent on the instrument of a physical body, that is to say, on everything contained within the instruments of the nervous and sensory systems. If we now draw two further parallel lines, we can say, corresponding with the sense organs and the nervous system in our physical organism, are what we might call the tools or instruments supporting this consciousness, especially the sense organs, and to a certain extent the nervous system. Below the threshold of this everyday consciousness lies everything which we designate as the concealed aspect of our soul's life, or the subconscious. We will gain a clear concept of all that is, as it were, embedded within this subconscious when we remember that human beings can, through spiritual training, acquire imagination, inspiration, and intuition. So, just as we placed concepts, feelings, and will impulses in the area of our usual consciousness, we have to place imagination, inspiration, and intuition in the area of the subconscious, and that's dotted lines in the diagram. Yet we also know that the workings of the subconscious are not only engaged under conditions of spiritual training, but can also manifest as a legacy of an original primitive state of human consciousness in the form of atavism. Then what we call visions arise. These visions, in what might be thought of as a more naive or primitive consciousness, correspond with regular, methodically achieved imaginations. inklings or premonitions would have arisen as a form of primitive inspirations, we can lead straight into an example of what the difference is between an inspiration and a premonition. We have often referred to the fact that during the course of the 20th century and integral to human evolution, a kind of spiritual return of Christ will occur, and that a certain number of people will experience, in etheric form, how Christ works into the world from out of the astral realm. Knowledge of this phenomenon can be confirmed by means of thorough schooling, training that acknowledges the nature of evolution, and again through regular training, accepts that this must take place in the 20th century. Yet it can happen, as is often the case nowadays, that here or there are individuals gifted with that natural primitive clairvoyance who possess the sort of darkened inspiration we called premonitions, and who will have an inkling of the approaching Christ. It is possible that those individuals will not know exactly what they are encountering, yet inspiration, even of such essential magnitude, can occur in the form of inklings or premonitions. For primitive or naive consciousness, something can occur that does not remain within the features of an inkling or vision. Vision replaces a spiritual process with an image. If, for example, a person has lost someone whose I, capital, has gone through the gate of death and is tarrying in the spiritual world, and the latter individual has created some link between themselves and the person still among the living, then the person in this world is likely not to know what their late acquaintance wants of them. They can then form a false concept of what the late person is experiencing in their soul. But the fact that any such connection exists elicits in the living a vision, which is intrinsically false, but which may, nevertheless, be founded on the correct fact that the dead person is seeking a connection with them. This manifests as an inkling or presentiment. In this way, the person who has premonitions somehow knows things either about the past or about the future, which are inaccessible to normal consciousness. However, if something presents itself to the human soul as a clear perception, not just as a vision, which can at any rate be false, but in the form of a clear perception, be it a process in the sense world or in a region inaccessible to ordinary senses, or be it a process in higher worlds. Such manifestations are in occult usage termed specifically deuteroscopy, or the second face, countenance, or visage. With this, I have only illustrated for you, whether this be achieved by rigorous inner schooling or by naturally occurring clairvoyance, what takes place within consciousness, certainly in the subconscious, but specifically in the human soul itself. As far as processes going on in the human soul itself are concerned, everything changes markedly once we broach the subject of the subconscious, as opposed to the processes taking place in everyday consciousness. In contrast to all that is our actual subject matter, and to use the mildest possible terms and suggestions that can be used in a public lecture, it can be said that the processes involved in everyday consciousness really amount to a state of unconsciousness. The I, EYE, sees a rose. This I itself behaves such that in us a concept of a rose arises. But this I is quite powerless in terms of normal consciousness, with all its perceptions in face of concepts of the emergence, growth, and withering of the rose. The rose grows and withers according to natural forces. But for as long as normal consciousness pertains, the I is capable of nothing other than grasping the immediate present. Only this is accessible to its perception. It is now not among the realities of the subconscious. This is what we need to hold on to, as it is extremely important. When we perceive something normally with our eyes, be it colorful pictures or anything else, not only can we change nothing through the very perceiving of objective items, but something else occurs if the seeing is normal. If nothing other than seeing alone confronts the eye also remains unchanged by seeing. Only when we cross the frontier between normal light and blinding light do we damage our eyes. Thus we can say, amongst the facts of normal consciousness, we do not, if we persistently remain among them, even affect ourselves. Our organisms are constructed such that through the verities of normal consciousness, even within ourselves, no changes are normally generated. What takes place in the subconscious is quite different. Supposing we create an imagination, or we have a vision. Let us now imagine this imagination or vision to correspond with some benevolent being. This good entity is not in the physically sensed world, but in the suprasensory world. Now, we wish to mentally move this world, in which the beings mentioned exist, and where we are seeing this imagination or vision, into the area, see diagram, between the two parallel lines. In the world we have mentally moved there, we wish to seek everything which can constitute an item, a perception, or become an object for the subconscious. We won't write anything in this space as yet. But if we represent anything in this world, whether in imaginary image or in vision, that is an evil or demonic being, it is then not the case that we ourselves are as powerless in relation to this presence as the eye is powerless in relation to the rose. If, when imagining or envisioning an evil being, we cultivate the feeling that it should yield to us, and we do this in concert with a totally clear and imaginatively visionary concept, then the being existing in that realm would in fact feel as though it were being thrust aside by a force emanating from us. It is just like this when we have a similar vision or imagination of a benevolent being. It is also the case, then, that if we develop a feeling of sympathy, the being can indeed sense the power within themselves to approach us and make a connection with us. All the beings existing in this realm can sense our forces, whether attracting or repelling them, when we create visionary imaginations of them. As regards our subconscious, we are then in a similar position to an eye which, simply by looking, were to see not just a rose, but also produce the desire for the rose to come nearer to it, and the belief that it could actually carry this out. Or, indeed, as if the eye were to see something repugnant, it would not only conclude that it is ugly, but that it should banish this ugliness through antipathy alone. The subconscious is, therefore, in contact with the world upon which sympathy and antipathy, which claim space in the soul, can have an influence. We need to lay this out for our souls. These sympathies and antipathies, in fact all the impulses and motivations working in our subconscious, are not active in this realm only in the way indicated, but affect primarily all that is contained within us as a part of our ether body. Not just as part of the human ether body, but even including certain forces of the physical body, and which we can now think of as enclosed between those two parallel lines. Into these parallels we must mentally place those forces pulsating through our blood, that is, the powers of warmth within our blood, and also those forces which are alive within our breathing. They in turn being conditioned by the overall health or sickliness of our entire organism. This more or less healthy force of breath we can summarize as its condition or fetal. Also belonging to and affected within us by the subconscious is the human ether body. Our consciousness affects us, as do those hidden forces of our soul life. They influence us through the warmth of our blood, and as this latter is dependent on its overall beat, the liveliness or sluggishness of our blood circulation, you can understand that our blood circulation must to a certain extent be connected with our subconscious. Whether someone has a brisker or slacker circulatory system depends largely on the forces in their subconscious. If the effect on all the demonic or divine beings in the outer world only occurs when human beings have visions, imaginations, or similar perceptions with a degree of clarity in their subconscious, if then, solely through sympathy or antipathy, certain forces become active in this world as if by magic, then this distinct soul manifestation in the subconscious is not necessary to affect the inner aspect of our organism, which itself consists of what has been described here. Whether or not someone is aware of which imaginations might correspond with a particular sympathy or another within themselves, this sympathy has an effect on their blood circulation, their breathing, and their ether body. Assume that a person has for some time had the tendency to have mainly repulsion-inducing experiences. If they were capable of having visions or imaginations, as described the day before yesterday, they would experience as perceptions their own being laid out before them. This would project into space, but would apply only to their own domain. These visions or imaginations would represent the forces of repulsion within them. But if someone in this situation cannot practice self-knowledge, yet may only have the feelings of disgust because they exist within, they will affect him personally. They do, in fact, influence the forces of warmth in their blood and their powers of breathing. So it is actually the case, to change the subject, that a person has a respiratory system that is more or less healthy depending on the feelings they experience in their subconscious, that their circulation is more or less vigorous, depending again on what they experience subconsciously. Ultimately, every process and activity in a person's ether body is dependent on their realm of feeling. What manifests when the events of the subconscious are really experienced by the soul is that not only are the two connected, but that they exercise a continuous effect upon the constitution of the person. Feelings, perceptions, or sensations play into the subconscious, instigating particular forms of warmth in the blood, particular conditions in the respiratory system and the ether body, which either support that organism or thwart its entire life. What plays out in the human subconscious always causes either thriving or decay. Human beings either diminish or replenish their life forces through what is sent down into their subconscious by their state of consciousness. If someone feels pleasantly complacent or indulgent toward a lie they have told, and feels no repugnance, the healthy response to lies, and if they are unconcerned or even pleased with themselves, these feelings will be added to their subconscious. What goes on in the subconscious taints blood circulation, respiratory health, and the forces of the ether body. The consequences of what has been described are that everything remaining in the person, when they go through the gate of death, causes atrophy, diminishes their strength, and that something in them dies, which would have been revived had the person experienced revulsion and disgust at the lies told, this being the healthy reaction. This healthy feeling of repugnance against lies would have descended, translating into the forces mentioned, and the person would have sent promising, burgeoning forces into their organism. We see how forces and issues are continually sent from our ordinary upper consciousness to our subconscious, and how we work at building growth or decay into ourselves. We are not powerful enough in our present state to corrupt other members of our being, issuing downward from our souls, other than our blood circulation, our respiratory system, and our ether bodies. We cannot degrade the coarser, more solid parts of our solid organisms, and are only capable of debasing parts of our overall constitution. What manifests as particularly degradable when the remaining parts of the ether body most closely linked with warmth of circulation and respiratory condition are influenced in this way, is that this ether body degenerates through negative feelings. However, it receives regenerative, nurturing, and strengthening forces from normal, genuinely affirmative feelings. We can say that human beings work directly upon the actual thriving or destruction of their own organism through what takes place in their subconscious. Put differently, settling into their unconscious from everyday awareness, processes of regeneration or decay take place within their souls, affecting their entire constitutional health. We have seen how, to varying degrees, our souls can experience and know something which also has an effect on the world, which, to use the words current throughout medieval times, we can call the elemental world. Humans cannot relate directly to this world, but only via the detour of first experiencing within themselves the effects of the subconscious as it impacts upon our organism. Anyone who has over time gained some self-knowledge knows that to have an emotion and transmit your behavior to your subconscious results either in destroying something, which then atrophies, or, if experienced differently, corollaries of that feeling settle into your subconscious and nurture you. If you sense this alternating rise and fall between health-giving and destructive forces over time, you will grow ever more mature in self-knowledge. This is what constitutes true self-knowledge, and it can be compared with the following image. Self-knowledge arrived at in the way described, when our instincts rise up in face of a lie or some wrongful reaction to a lie, would attract a sensation akin to a scorpion biting off your toe. You can be sure that were people to be aware of this very real effect, they would tell fewer lies than they do. If our physical body were to be mutilated in the physical world, this would be comparable with what happens, though we do not normally notice it, when daily experiences are transmitted into the subconscious. When a lax disregard of lying is endemic in the subconscious, something is removed, bitten off our organism, whereby we are impoverished, and which we will only be able to retrieve over the further course of our karma. If we transmit a principled feeling into our subconscious, and we need to think of this in terms of a thousandfold scale of sensations sinking downward, then we grow in ourselves, building new life forces into our organism. Observing this growth and decay is what causes genuine self-knowledge to arise within us. I was told yesterday that some people did not fully understand what I said about distinguishing between a real vision or imagination, which belongs among what is objective, from something that merely projects itself into a space, only pertains to us, and is subjective. You cannot say, write down this rule, then that, and you'll be able to distinguish. They don't exist, and you learn gradually by developing. Properly differentiating between what only concerns ourselves and what manifests as an external vision pertaining to a being can only be reliable when one has oneself suffered the continually biting attacks originating in those lethal subconscious processes. By then you will be equipped with a reasonable amount of certainty. Yet it can always happen that one can cause a vision or imagination to appear of which one queries, can I, through the power of my spiritual sight, see through it? Does the vision remain static under scrutiny by the active power of my evolved gaze? If so, it corresponds with an objective fact. If the active force of my gazing obliterates the vision, then it pertains only to my subjective self. Someone in this situation who is not alert in this sense can, as far as I'm concerned, array thousands of pictures from the Akasha Chronicle. If they do not apply the test as to whether the image is extinguished or not under active gaze, than the Akashic images, however endless the knowledge they impart, can only be seen as relating to the inner world of that person. It might happen, I say might, that a person sees nothing more than their own interior, and that this is projected in many dramatic images, which they might expand, say, throughout the Atlantean world and over generations of human evolution. This could, under certain circumstances, be nothing more, however objective it might appear, than a projection of their own internal domain. When a person has gone through the gate of death, the situation always arises in which those hindrances, through which their inherent subjectivity became objective vision or imagination, are no longer present. In normal present-day lives, what people experience inwardly and unconsciously, what they transmit to their subconscious, are not always visions and imaginations. They become imaginations through regular training, visions in the case of atavistic clairvoyance. When someone has gone through the portal of death, the sum total of their inner life instantly becomes an objective world. It is right there. Kamaloka is fundamentally nothing other than a world, built up all around us, of everything that we have experienced in our souls. Only in Devakan is this positively reversed. So we can easily understand that what I said about the consequences of sympathy and antipathy present in visions, imagination, inspiration, and premonitions, or inklings, does always, in every circumstance, affect the objective elemental world. I said that in the case of a human being incarnated in the physical world, only what they have elevated to vision or imagination has an effect on the elemental world. In someone who has died, those forces, which used to exist in their subconscious and which they subsequently brought with them when they passed through the gate of death, always do have an effect, working into the elemental world. Thus, everything a person has experienced entirely pervades the whole elemental world. Just as surely as you create waves in a stream when you hit the water, are the experiences of the dead perpetuated in the elemental world, with that very same inevitability as waves replicate themselves outward from the point where you hit the water's surface. Or they are perpetuated in the elemental world with the same certitude as a flow of air regenerates itself. This is why the elemental world is constantly filled with everything that human beings have incited in their subconscious and which they bring with them when they die. So it is always only a matter of being in a position to create conditions for seeing and perceiving things in the elemental world. One need not be at all surprised if a seer correctly recognizes and describes what appears in the elemental world as being the consequential effects of the dead. As you will see, one can also pursue these effects of the deceased's experiences right into the physical world, albeit under particular conditions, as they begin to work into the elemental world. If the seer has him or herself undergone all that I have described as relating to the elemental world, they can attain over time to having remarkable experiences. Imagine a seer goes through the following process. Firstly, let's say he can see a rose. He looks at the rose with physical eyes. Looking in this way, the seer has a sense impression. Imagine further that the seer has trained him or herself to have a particular feeling on encountering the color red. This is essential, otherwise the process ends there. Without associating colors or tones with certain nuances of feeling, clairvoyance directed at external objects cannot progress. Imagine the rose is laid aside. If they were no clairvoyant, such a feeling would descend into their subconscious and down there would act upon their health or sickliness. If they are indeed a seer, they will now perceive what effect the imagination of the rose is having in their subconscious. In other words, they will have an imagination of a rose, They will simultaneously perceive whether it is working supportively or destructively on their physical or ether body. Having this imagination, they will now be able to exert a force of attraction on the being we may call the group soul of the rose. They will see the group soul of the rose inasmuch as it exists as such in the elemental world. If the seer now goes further, having started by looking at the rose, set aside the rose and followed the inner process of surrender to the rose and its ensuing effect, then, arriving at the point of seeing the trace of the rose in the elemental world, thus seeing in the space the rose appeared to them a quite wonderfully radiant picture as part of the elemental world. Having followed the process this far, something occurs. One can refrain from seeing what is in front of one. One can instruct oneself, "Do not view with your inner gaze what you have extending from you into the world in the form of a living etheric entity." Then the strange phenomenon arises that the seer sees something going through their eye, EYE, which shows them how those forces work, which build up their eye from out of the human ether body. They see the forces concerned with constructively forming their own physical bodies. They really see their physical eye as if it were an external object. This can happen. You can make your way from outer object to the point where you are in an otherwise totally dark room. You cannot allow any other sense and perceptions in, and you see what the eye looks like as a spiritual image. You yourself see your inner organ. With this you find yourself in a realm which in truth creates the physical world. You only perceive this creative physical world by first perceiving how you are physically constituted. So, you are retracing a path back to yourself. What transmits such forces into our eye, that we positively see our eye as if radiating rays of light were streaming from it, rays that most readily correspond with the essence of our gaze? We see the eye bordered by a sort of yellow glow. We see the eye enclosed within us. This has been caused by the whole progression of forces which have ultimately brought human beings to their present stage. The same course is now taken by the forces which may emanate from someone who has died. They take with them the contents of their subconscious into the world where they tarry after going through the gate of death. In the same way as we penetrate our own physical eye, do the forces radiated by the dead return from the elemental world into the physical plane. The deceased may feel a particular longing for someone they have left behind. This particular longing is initially in their subconscious, but it swiftly becomes a living vision through which they affect the elemental world. Here, in the realm of the elements, what was mere vision now becomes a power. This force makes its way as given by the longing for the living person, and if the opportunity arises, it rumbles, it polters, and bumps around in the physical world in the vicinity of the person still living, who hears certain sounds of disturbance, which they perceive in the same way as they sense any physical effect. Readers aside, the word polters, of course, is P-O-L-T-E-R-S. I'm assuming that's from the word poltergeist kind of thing. Okay, end of readers aside. These events, hailing as they do from a source such as this, would more readily be taken for normal were people to take greater note of the times favorable to such influences, which are when falling asleep and waking up. Not only do people pay no attention to these events, but there can hardly be anyone who has not encountered manifestations from the spiritual world in that transition between falling asleep and waking, whether polter activity or even words. I wanted to point this out to you today for the purpose of demonstrating in actual reality the connection between human beings and the world. What a person derives with mundane consciousness from the objective sense world itself is powerless and seemingly without genuine context in that sense world. But no sooner have that person's experiences sunk into their subconscious, a connection with reality is forged. The swooning or unconscious state of the previous level of awareness turns into a fine sort of magic. And once that person has gone through the portal of death, is freed from their physical body, their experiences are such that they work into the elemental world, and under favorable conditions, have an effect right into the physical world, where they can be perceived by normal consciousness. I have portrayed this in the simplest form in which it can take place, because one has to begin with the simplest of cases. Obviously, and having as always left sufficient time to gradually work further on the matters about which we need to know, we will move on to more complex issues, which will in turn lead us into the more intimate connections between the human being and the world. The end of Lecture 6.